May it please the court, my name is Bob Lighthizer. I represent the Alleys, petitioners in this case. Despite my gray hair, I've only practiced for about 10 years, and I'm a little bit thrilled and awed to be here. I was recently here at your appellate practice session, but they didn't even tell me how to address you. Having gotten rid of my preliminaries, I want to briefly describe my case. In this case, Mr. Benzer guaranteed a loan at a Metropolitan Bank for a man by the name of Tom Morris. The loan was for $140,000. Mr. Benzer was paid $40,000 for his guarantee. Mr. Morris paid off maybe $35,000 of the loan and then defaulted. Mr. Benzer had to honor his guarantee and paid off Metropolitan Bank $108,000 and had assigned to him the Morris note and a deed of trust on a piece of property. Three or four months later, Morris and Benzer got together and entered into something called a renewal and extension agreement. This is a comprehensive agreement that basically renews and extends the Morris note for 2 months. For this, Mr. Benzer received $60,000. He applied $27,000 of it, this is in round numbers, $27,000 of it to the principal that he was owed or that he had paid off Metropolitan Bank. So that left roughly from $108,000 minus $27,000, $81,000 on. He applied $3,000 to the interest that he said was due between the time that he assumed the or paid off Metropolitan Bank and the date of this agreement. And he applied $30,000 for the 2 months renewal. He also charged, I believe, 18% interest during that 2 months period. Mr. Morris never paid any more to Mr. Benzer, and Mr. Benzer eventually demanded 2 months later or so the payment of the $81,000 plus interest and so forth. In the meantime, or around about this time, Mr. Morris did this deal again. This time he went to Independence Bank and borrowed, I think, $150,000, and he got some guarantors there, which are the Alleys. On that loan, I don't think he paid anything. And, of course, the Alleys parties had to come in and pay off their guarantee, and then they were assigned the note and the deed of trust on the same property that Mr. Morris had pledged before. So that we have Mr. Benzer, in effect, holding a first lien on this property and the Alley parties holding a second lien. This court granted the writ of error on 2 points. The first point is that a junior lien, the Court of Appeals erred in concluding that a junior lien holder does not have standing to assert the usury claim that a third party borrower might have against the senior lien holder. The law on this is very short, and I thought my arguments ought to be short because there really are two cases. The first case is the Maloney versus Earhart case decided by this court around 1891, and the other case is and Maloney versus Earhart is directly in point. It's a junior lien holder case, so forth. The other case that the Court of Appeals found to be in conflict was the Houston Sash and Door case, decided by this court around 1977. In its opinion, the Court of Appeals wasn't too sure of itself because after making its decision that Houston Sash controlled, it said, therefore, we leave it to the Supreme Court to state whether a junior lien holder is an exception to the rule that rights of redress provided by the present usury statutes are restricted to the immediate parties to the transaction. And that's our real issue here, is whether the alley parties can take advantage of the Maloney decision. Maloney was a case that the second lien holder had foreclosed, and the first lien holder came in and sued the original debtor for his debt or for his property, and he didn't get either. The Supreme Court came along and it said that it's contended that the Court of Appeals erred in sustaining the plea of usury because that plea is a personal privilege of the debtor and was not available to the purchaser under the junior mortgage after a settlement between the debtor and the first mortgagee. And then continuing on, we think the reasons are stronger for holding that a junior mortgagee or the purchaser under such a mortgage who has the right to pay off the debt that creates the prior encumbrance should have the right to discharge such encumbrance by paying only so much of the debt as is recognized by the law to be valid. That sentence contains the big distinction that we are making between Maloney and the Houston Sash case, which Houston Sash applies the current usury statute, and the penalty provision contains the language that the penalties are recovered or are payable to the obligator, meaning the direct debtor. Maloney accepts that, really, because it is not saying that we are paying money to the debtor. We are merely paying, the junior lien holder is not recovering money, he is merely paying off what has historically been recognized as his right, namely the amount owed on the senior lien. And if there is nothing owed because that debt is against the law of the state, then he shouldn't have to pay anything. Maloney would have undoubtedly not have been a problem, or this would probably not have arisen, really, if the legislature had not come along around, near as I can tell, 1983, and changed the usury statutes that were in effect in the Maloney era. Back in that day, the usury statute said, all contracts for usury are contrary to public policy and shall be void. And then it goes on, which it's recited in the Maloney case. The current usury statute says all contracts for usury are contrary to public policy, that part's the same, and shall be subject to the appropriate penalties prescribed in Article 1.06 of this subtitle. It is Article 1.06 that contains this language, that it's only the obligator who is entitled to recover the penalties. The Court of Appeals reasoned that in the light of the Houston Sash case saying only an obligator can recover, the junior lien holder did not have standing. And the distinction just is that the junior lien holder is not the same type person as Houston Sash is talking about. Houston Sash is a guarantor case. In a guarantee, this court held that the guarantor is obligated on his own contract, and he is trying to assert a defense of his debtor on another contract. Thus, he is obligated on his guarantee contract. Similar cases to that effect are where you purchase a piece of property and part of your consideration is a usurious mortgage. You entered into the deal voluntarily, you got your consideration, it was part of the mortgage. It's a different class of debtor. The Ali parties are total strangers to the transaction, except that they have a common interest in the same mortgage property. And that is the rationale of the Maloney case, and it's spelled out in a Court of Appeals opinion of the same era, Johnson versus Alaska Real Estate or something like that. Maloney does not in it contain a detailed discussion citing many cases that you can go back at and look at the development of the law. It was decided by about the same court that in 1890, for instance, said that Texas recognized common law usury, even apart from statutory usury. This court recently agreed that that is still true in the Denzinger versus San Jacinto Savings case. The right, Maloney may have part of its basis just laying in the common law. The reason is that the right of a junior mortgagee to protect his mortgage, it has always been just a common law right that if he pays off a senior mortgage, a mortgage is not an interest in the property except to the extent of the right to be paid. It's not a fee type interest. And if the senior lien holder is paid off, then he has no further interest. He can't assert any further claims in the property. And that has always been a sort of a common law right of the junior lien holder, and perhaps part of Maloney's basis is on that. The big question comes up is when the legislature changed the wording of the statute in 1963, did it change the law? And the only answer you can have of this is, I guess, that the legislature is presumed to know what this court ruled and what the general law was. It left intact the statement that that usury is against the public policy of the state. It merely shifted the penalty thing from the contracts for usury or void to a more comprehensive penalty statute, which it sticks in the word that this is to the obligator. But that would not seem to change the idea that the debt is still void because of the usury. And as almost a throwaway argument, Article 5069, 1.06, Section 2, for instance, has as an additional penalty, and it does not contain the to the obligator language. Our usury here is grossly greater than two times the amount allowable by law, so we would fall under that second section.
If you had a different situation here, rather than your client having a lien against the property, if your client were an unsecured creditor of Mr. Morris, would you still have the right to attack the lien on that piece of property help Mr. Benzer?
No, because I believe that you would then be a stranger to the whole thing. The reason you're not a stranger is you have a common interest in the same piece of property.
Well, you have a common interest in the same creditor because he owes both of you. He defrauded both of you on these loans he made out and talked to your clients and Mr. Denzer into guaranteeing.
Yeah.
If you follow the theory that usury voids the contract as set out in Maloney, why could not an unsecured creditor come in and attack a usurious note securing a lien and put himself ahead of that lien holder?
It would seem to me, though, that Maloney gives me this right because I have the right as a junior lien holder to pay off what is fair and justly owed to the senior lien holder. in an unsecured creditor case, there's no, not only no right, there's no requirement I pay him anything. We're not doing it for my own. I would not pay off the unsecured creditor. I wouldn't get anything if I paid him off.
Well, then you're saying the theory that usury voids
completely
applies only in a lien situation?
I see. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I misunderstood what we were talking about a little bit. We were talking about the unsecured creditor coming along and saying the secured creditor's lien is no good, and therefore the property is free, and I'm free to go get it.
Mm-hmm.
My view is that it's a good argument. It isn't my case because my view really was that there probably is some standing type requirement and some common interest. And Maloney addressed only the issue because you had a common interest in something.
Well,
other than just being a debtor.
Well, I understood your argument was based on the theory that usury voids the contract, voids the lien, period. Now, if usury voids the lien, period, that's a broad general brush we're painting with, then it voids the lien as to everybody down there who might have some cause of action against this debtor, wouldn't it?
No, my argument was not that broad.
Well, but the theory would have to apply, wouldn't it? Unless you want to put some restrictions. The next question is, where do you start putting these restrictions in on this broad theory that usury voids the contract?
Well, this court has said usurious contracts remain void. And I don't know precisely what that means.
That's what I'm trying to...
I guess I would limit it to the case where there was clearly some direct relation that is between the creditors, other than just being a creditor in general. I mean, I think it's fine if the court wants to extend it generally. That sounds fine to me, too, but I mean, I don't have a problem with it, but at least I've been looking at it that the creditors themselves have to have some relation to each other, other than just being a creditor of the debtor. Now, of course, I suppose if you do go off into bankruptcy court, you can do just what you're talking about, I believe.
Let me clear something up. This debt was that now asserts to be senior of Benson's. Benson was originally a third in line, was he not? And by buying out the first lien holder's interest, he leapfrogged ahead of number two?
No, sir.
Is that not right?
Morris pledged the property two times. And the first time he pledged it to one bank that Benzer guaranteed, and the second time he pledged it to another bank that the Ali people guaranteed. Benzer comes along and has to pay off his guarantee, and then after he paid his guarantee off, Morris went out and pledged the property again, and the Ali's then had to pay off their guarantee. So it was first, Benzer was a first. His bank was first, and the other bank was, the Ali bank was second. The other point of error that the court granted was that the concurring opinion in the Court of Appeals agreed with sort of, I think, the argument that I've just made on point of error one, but then went ahead and said we still were not okay because, well, the point of error is that it erred insofar as this concurring opinion was that the usurious renewal and extension agreement would not taint and invalidate a respondent's original note and deed of trust lien. The theory here is that the original note to Metropolitan Bank was not usurious. The usury arose in Mr. Benzer's scramble to collect the note after it had been assigned to him, and in his renewal and extension agreement. This court had held, and I think it was Kane versus Bonner with this court's opinion, but anyway, this court had held that where the renewal note was tainted with usury, that fine, the creditor could just blow it off if it was not, if the original notes were not barred by limitations, and proceed under them. And the Court of Appeals held, or the concurring judge's opinion was, that that was a good defense. Well, it's always been the law that a note that is out there that is originally usurious does not lose its character merely because it's negotiated. And that is contained, for instance, in the Maloney opinion, and there are later cases that hold to the effect that a usurious note doesn't gain any credibility by being circulated. The usury statute, in effect, in Maloney's day, and where these opinions, the Kane versus Bonner case, where those opinions were written, simply made the usurious contract void. Thus, you could not enforce the contract out there for usury, and you were entitled to recover the usurious interest you'd actually paid. The new statute doesn't do that. It contains the language of charged and so forth that makes it just much more comprehensive. This was discussed in a case of Gold versus Alamo Lumber, which this court considered on another point, and the Court of Appeals discussed this matter and concluded that these old cases were not were no longer good law, and the view of the LE parties would be that if they paid off Mr. Morris, Mr. Benzer, pardon me, he wants his full money that doesn't include the amount for the usurious interest. They certainly know he had a usurious contract out there. They pay it off. There is no new note. I mean, it's still the same old note, and he applied the money on that old note. They pay it off, and they go try to collect their money from Mr. Morris, and they would be entitled to sue Mr. Morris for it. Well, I think under the new statute, Mr. Morris can come along and assert the usuries against the LE parties. If he can't, it sure isn't clear that he can't. Mr. Benzer created this mess, and therefore I don't think that the LE parties should be the ones that have to sort it out. And therefore, I think that the point of error three, insofar as since this court granted error on that basis, that the concurring opinion is wrong on this point. Point of error two was not granted, but was simply that the contract was usurious. The main issue that seemed to have come up was the forbearance. It was a contract for forbearance rather than a contract for interest. Well, the thing gave a $10,000 rebate if you paid within 1 month. I think that probably is interest for money. I mean, that's a charge for the advancement of money. And would make it usurious, and I cited all the cases in my brief on this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. Any questions? Thank you, Counselor. We will now hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. McNeese will present argument for the respondent.
If the Court please, the respondents ask that the Court affirm the decision by the Court of Appeal. As the counsel mentioned, it's quite a mess here. Actually, the original guy that borrowed the money is no longer in it. The two banks that loaned money is no longer in it. The and it's been the same title company issued first lien title policies in both cases. Our position is that the petitions here do not have the standing to declare the position of Mr. Benzer usurious. The statute itself is very clear, and the statutes on usury are made to protect so-called people who are hard up and need to borrow money, and it's to protect them. And so the statute gives the right to such a person who makes such a loan a right for damages, for recovery, for declared null and void, and things like that, if it is a usurious note. But it's just for that person and nobody else. That person and the immediate, those immediately in the deal, those pretty well. A third party really doesn't have a right to have the document declared void because of usury.
If the third party's inferior lien is going to be diminished by usurious lien that is in front of it,
yes,
and thereby would cause harm if the usurious lien holder were to foreclose, cause harm to that junior lien holder,
yes,
why shouldn't he have standing? And why doesn't that fit the normal definition of standing to seek a legal remedy in court?
Well, he does not have a standing to have it declared a void because of usury.
If it hurts him, why shouldn't he have that right?
Because he comes in and makes a loan on the property. He takes it like it is. He's doing it voluntarily, freely. Nobody's forcing him to do this. When he took the lien on the property, there was a prior lien on it. And he recognized, under law, you recognize a prior recorded lien on the property. Now, subsequently, this renewal and extension agreement was made. Now, incidentally, it does have provision that if it is void or declared invalid by court, then the original note is the way it's going to be paid. It has that provision in it, in the renewal and extension agreement. And I'm saying this, that the petitions here don't have the right to attack the alleged usurious document. But at the same time, I would say perhaps it's not binding on it. The thing it's binding on is on the recorded lien when they made their lien on the property. And in my opinion, their relief would be to tender the balance due on the original note, because that's the matter of record. Probably had no notice or did not even know of this extension or renewal agreement. So equity or by law, they would have a right, a junior lien holder has a right to pay off the first lien. And so they would have a right to tender. In this case, they could have pled and made a tender of whatever the balance due on the original first lien note. And then they would have a standing. But they're not doing that. And they waived that right. They're attempting to declare this renewal and extension agreement, or whatever debt that Danzer has void under usury law, that they don't have, they are not in a privative interest to do that.
Isn't that what the public policy of the statute says, that the usurious note cannot be collected if it's more than, charges more than twice the allowed amount of interest?
It says that the obligor, which would be Morris in this case, would have a right for recovery. He can sue for damages. He can have a document declared void. But he's not doing it. This is somebody else completely different, and not the obligor as specifically stated in the statute. And as in the Houston Sagedor case, it says the same thing, the immediate parties.
Counsel, what you're saying is that the guarantor may say he does not want to pay the note because it's usurious to the one who loaned the money, but that's as far as it goes. Each one of those guarantors could have asserted that the note was usurious, that they guaranteed, and they could have gotten out of paying it. But not having done that, as between the two guarantors, one cannot assert any usury rights.
Yes. Well, I'm saying, see, there are actually two notes.
Right.
Benzer was the guarantor on the first note, and then subsequent to that, Morris goes to another bank and tries to borrow some money, say, well, you've got to have some guarantors on this note. So he gets some other guarantors, and that's the Hiley group.
But the usury that's asserted is not against the first note, the Metropolitan Bank. It's a renewal and extension agreement. And nobody guaranteed that renewal and extension agreement, did they?
No, sir.
Consequently, the guarantor of the second note was not on notice of that.
I don't think that he knew it. I don't think it was recorded. I don't think he knew about it. So under that state of facts, he has the right as a junior lien holder, I think, to pay off whatever is due on the note and the recorded lien. And he would have that right. And he would have a right to plead that, he would have a right to make that tender, and he'd have a signing in the court. But he didn't do that.
But the tender that would have been demanded would have been under the renewal and extension note, would it not?
He could have pled and made a tender under the original note. He said, this is the recorded lien. This is the note that I recognize, recorded. I don't even know anything about this other thing. I'm not bound by it. Don't have anything to do with it. He could have made a tender and pled, I'm paying you whatever is due under the original note. But he didn't do it. Therefore, he has no standing in the court. And for that reason, we ask that the dishonorable court affirm the court of appeals that says that the LA's recover nothing against Mr. Benson.
Let me make sure I understand you, Mr. Meese.
Mm-hmm.
Your theory is that Mr. Alley took a lien on this property subject only to any prior recorded liens. The only prior recorded lien was the indebtedness of Morris to the bank, which was guaranteed by Benson. And therefore, Mr. Alley's rights were to go in and said, I am going to discharge that first lien, and my lien will then become the first lien. But he didn't do that. Instead of that, he turned around and sued Benzer, saying that maybe Benzer had some lien on the property that he was trying to declare void. He didn't even attack the one lien that was superior to his, as far as real property law is concerned. That's your argument.
That's my position.
I want to make sure that is.
Yeah, that's my position. He, as a junior lien holder, as you know, a junior lien holder has the right to pay off the first lien. The first lien he had the right to pay off was the only lien he knew about, we'll say, the recorded lien. He could have pled and made a tender. Whatever the balance due is on that note, here it is. Pay it off. Then he becomes the first lien holder.
You're saying if it's usurious, so just erase that, you go ahead and pay what you really owe. Intended that.
What the recorded lien note says.
So that the fact that the renewal and extension note was usuriously charged, which is a violation, does not taint the original transaction.
That's right, John. In other words, the Allies didn't even know about this other day. And another thing, like I mentioned too, the other even thing says even if it is void, then you use the original note anyway. And so they, in other words, the LAs wouldn't be out one penny on account of this. So renewal and extension.
The conditional
aspect of this renewal note doesn't remove the taint of the usury note, does it? Because if you charge it or assert it, that's usury, no matter whether you try to collect it or not.
That's true, but that was the deal between Benson and Morris. But that doesn't affect their rights. They're not a part of that agreement, and as I say under the statute, they don't have a right to attack that document. But it does not affect Ali's rights as a junior lien holder against the valid recorded lien. They could have paid off that note.
Go a little further on that, Mr. McNeese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought I understood from the prior counsel's statement of facts that Bender paid off the bank on the note that he had guaranteed, the note that had been executed with Morris. Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, would that not then serve to discharge that first lien?
No, he took an assignment of the first lien.
So he, Bender, still owns that first lien.
Owns the first lien. And the tender would have been made to him as to the amount under the recorded lien note. If they would have made a tender of what was due under the recorded lien note, they'd be in good shape. But they didn't do it.
Well, what effect, if any, would this renewal that Morris executed in favor of Benzer have on the validity of that first lien?
Well, the only lien that the Allies knew about would be that first one, and that was the only one that they're really concerned with. In my opinion, under the law, that's all they had to do was to pay off the first lien note, whatever the balance was on that. And I think under the law that, and under the statute specifically, and under the court's ruling in the Houston Saxon Door case, Morris and Benzer, they were the only two people of the transaction, and they're the only ones that had a right to take any action about that under the statute itself. And these third parties have come along with another lien on the property under the statute specifically are not immediate parties to the transaction and have no right to have it declared void for usury.
You do acknowledge that the usurious contract would affect the recovery of the alleys in the case. Would it affect the amount of it?
No. No, I say that under the law, the only thing they would have to pay off is what was on the recorded first lien. I don't think they even knew about this either. At the time they made their second lien on the property, they didn't even know about the renewal extension agreement. And in my opinion, under the law, the only thing they'd have to pay off would be give the credits, whatever the credits are, whatever payments have been made by Morris, would be applied on that first note, and they would have, and they could pay the balance.
Is there any dispute about the fact that the extension and renewal note was usurious?
Anyone?
Any dispute about the fact that the extension and
renewal note was usurious? Oh, there could be, yes. Matter of fact, when they made it, see, Benson, in his deposition, he states that, which is by the record, he was out of conservative, he's not a very well-to-do man, and when the bank called him with all this money, come up with $108,000. He had to sell stuff. He had to sell things before maturity. There was a lot of penalties he was involved with. There's a lot of other deals that he could have been made that he lost. And he was out a substantial amount of money in his opinion. And in his testimony is what he said.
You're talking about the circumstances, but I'm just asking, is there any dispute about the fact that the renewal and extension note provided for a usurious rate of interest?
Yes, Benson feels like that he was actually entitled to the amount of money that he was paid there to reimburse him for the damages and to carry it further. But again, they actually built into the agreement that if the thing should be declared invalid, then the original note still stood good.
his argument is that all those other expenses were not for the retention of money.
That's right. For damages, he's standing there having to come up and pay off $108,000. He really had to scramble to come up that much cash. Particularly in time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your
Honor. Any further questions? Thank you, Counsel. We will now hear rebuttal from the petitioners.
In listening, I'm a little confused. There are only two goats involved here, and then there is this renewal and extension agreement. The first note was Mr. Benzer's note he got from Metropolitan Bank, and he renewed and extended that note and deed of trust without getting a new note signed. It contains a saving clause that says if the renewal and extension agreement, a term of it, is declared void, then what's left continues. We're not really seeking to declare that thing void. It may be, but I don't think that is what that savings clause is. Not the type of thing that saves you in usury, where you then go over to the deed of trust, which has buried in some footnote over there that says that if I charge usurious interest, I didn't mean it, and you ought to forgive me. There's no savings clause like that in this renewal and extension agreement. The idea that we should tender, I'm sure Mr. Benzer would have liked very much if we tendered the original $140,000 on the recorded note. I mean, he'd be home free and gone. I think that's exactly why you have the declaratory judgment, some way to bring it before court and get the rights declared. The other thing is that we are seeking as second lien holders only to pay what is justly due and owing on the first lien. And because of Mr. Benzer's manipulations and scrambling around, there's nothing left because he violated the usury statutes all over the place. Finally, there are a couple of points that have been alluded to, such as...
Kevin, let me ask you before you pass by that. How's your client hurt if he tenders his balance on the original note with as evidenced by the recording of the trust? If your client made an offer to pay off the first lien note as it was recorded, then how could your client be heard if anything else turned up in your service?
Because he said he's out $140,000 or $108,000 or $81,000. He's just out. I mean, Mr. Benzer's gone.
Now, he never expected to get a $140,000 windfall, either.
He did expect, though, that what was being done out there was according to the laws of the state. He made his contracts, at least, that were everybody else is playing by the same rules. And so he was hurt because he's hurt. You know, the usury statute still contains that it is against public policy, and that's sort of the way I read it. But everybody got played by the same rules. Mr. Benzer is playing by a little different set, and Mr. Benzer comes out of this real well. Mr. Benzer is only really out at this day, out of pocket. I mean, you know, not he didn't get his interest and all that. He's only had about $8,000 when you take his original guarantee, his $60,000, and so forth. So he's not bad a shape, but he wants $81,000 plus interest at 18% from November of, I forgot the year now, 85 or something like that.
Is there anything in the record as to why that title company or issued as first lien binder gift fund hadn't been brought into the bank?
There's nothing in the record. Just Mr. Marsh was a real good talker. He's gone. I mean, he filed bankruptcy. That is in the record. He got dismissed because the bankruptcy court didn't even want to listen to him either. and all these creditors went and put in jail, basically.
But you had a title policy guaranteeing your first lien. Is that right?
That's correct.
That hasn't been paid yet?
No, it has not been paid.
The forbearance argument and the services that are independent and that would make the charge not usury were not raised in the trial court in the response to the motion for summary judgment or in the Mr. Benzer's motion for summary judgment or in his response to the LV's motion for summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.